on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Thanks to you, Laura Fox. It's Thursday, the 3rd of March, and this is Game On. Coming up today, more tension across the sporting world as war continues.
I mean, this is bigger than football, and I'm proud of the football family, that football family stood together and we helped as much as we could. So it's really hard to say what can happen tomorrow. We are all just hoping and praying that the war stops.
That's the UEFA reaction as things stand. More on that with Ina Rudin very shortly. Plus, we've Jeff Shepherd on the fallout for Russian sports stars in the US. And in Gaelic football, Neil Ewing will take stock for us at the halfway point of the Allianz League. Plus, in Formula One, we'll set you up for the return of Drive to Survive on Netflix. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, a little bit of news before we get started. Anthony Eddy, the director of Sevens and Ireland Women's Rugby, has advised the RFU his desire to vacate his post with immediate effect. Eddy had been in charge of the Irish Women's Rugby since 2014, and the RFU will have a briefing tomorrow in relation to the independent report conducted by Fair Play Limited into the failure of Ireland's women to qualify for the Rugby World Cup, which was delayed till 2022 due to COVID. We will be looking at that tomorrow for sure. It's said to be extremely interesting, and it's something that we have covered over the last while, so we will be very curious to see what the outcome of is that, and it's brilliant to see it published for a start. Also, just staying with rugby, prop Andrew Porter has become Ireland's second first choice front row to be ruled out for the rest of the Six Nations after suffering an ankle injury in last weekend's victory over Italy. Robbie Hench, however, has passed his HIA and will return to play, provided that he comes through the return to play protocols for Ireland's visit to Twickenham. And in golf, the Arnold Palmer Invitational is underway, and sitting on top of the leaderboard is Rory McIlroy. He is through 16 and on 7 under, and right behind him is Graeme McDowell through 17 and on 5 under. Padraig Harrington is also out on the course as well, and he is through 5 and on even par, so we'll be updating you on that throughout the hour. Seamus Power is also out there. He is through 2 and on even par as well. Now, Ian O'Riordan is with me in studio. Ian, there's an awful lot to get through because there's so many stories coming out in relation to what is happening with Russia and the Ukraine at the moment. And the latest is that Russian and Belarusian athletes will be banned from the Beijing Winter Paralympics after the International Paralympic Committee reversed its original decision. So yesterday it was expected that they were going to be allowed to compete under a neutral flag. There was a lot of criticism, and there was even threats of a boycott. And then this morning it was announced that they wouldn't be able to compete.
Yeah, exactly, Mary. Another tense day on the Russian-Ukraine front, and not just in the war sense. And that's the really sad thing about this is, I mean, sport is just another casualty of many things and many facets of life here. And it almost seems a bit flippant to even be making issues of this. But you're right about the Paralympics. And I was actually looking at the Olympic records this morning. This is pretty unprecedented for two nations, two main nations. Obviously, Russia, I think they had about 83 athletes, Belarus less so, but to be pulled on the eve of the games, having been in the village, checked into the village, got their gear, got the usual stuff, and then they're like, actually, no, you can't compete. But you're right. I think the quote that came out of the International Paralympics Committee this morning was it was no longer tenable. It was untenable. Essentially, what happened was they decided on Wednesday night that they would agree to let the athletes compete under the so-called neutral flag. They weren't even going to be able to participate in medal ceremonies. If they won medals, they wouldn't even be able to stand on the podium. So it was pretty much a kind of as watered down as you could get. But on the flip side of that, of course, you had Ukrainian athletes competing. They checked into the village. You had a whole other nations who were being impacted by this event, and they were threatening to withdraw. So at that point, they had no option but to say, look. And in fairness, they actually apologised to the athletes because for their opportunity to be withdrawn at the last minute. Sure, it's very difficult. It's very sad. It's very very sorry. But I don't think they had any option at this stage. And I'm looking at the list of sports here who've now decided they're either going to suspend, ban Russia indefinitely, Belarus obviously. I mean, it's pretty much every sport that I know of. By the way, some were quicker to react than others. And I was going through the list here as well, and everyone's saying, oh, it wasn't great that FIFA and UEFA came out, but they were a little bit slow to react. And I think it was when they finally listened to dare I say, the athletes and the teams, and they realised, look, this is the decision to make. As someone who were kind of sitting on the fence for a while or saying, well, look, we'll leave it up to maybe the individual countries, whether they want to compete or not. But looking at the list now, I think it's a pretty much widespread wholesale ban on Russia, which is exactly what it should be.
However, though, the Russian Football Union have said that they are going to the Court of Arbitration for Sport to appeal against its ban from international competitions. And when it comes to CAS, it's really hard to even try and predict what the outcome could be of that.
Very valid, very good point. Again, I was writing a piece actually this weekend looking at some of the countries who have been banned already. Now, track and field, ironically, was the one country to stand up to Russia. They've been banned. Russians have been banned in track and field since 2015. The famous McLaren report, when there was doping came out of London and Sochi and all of that, and they've held that ban right through since 2015. Now, again, there was the neutral athlete, or the neutral kind of athletes, whereby if you could somehow prove that you never doped, you could compete. But athletics was the only sport to have that ban in place. And then there was, when WADA recommended a 4-year ban to Russia, that was taken to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and they were absolutely adamant that we've got the evidence here, it's pretty clear they were completely violating anti-doping rules. And of course, what does CAS do? They cut the ban in half, and again they watered down some of the sanctions. So it's going to be interesting, because CAS has a history of looking at the human interest side, I suppose, of things as well, or the human rights side, I should say. So that's going to be an interesting one. But again, it's kind of sad that even to think the Russian soccer team are going to go to that level.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Jeff Shepherd is with us as well, all the way from the United States of America. Shep, when we think about sports and what association we would have with Russia, hockey always comes to mind. And I'd imagine there's an awful lot of Russian hockey players in the NHL.
Yeah, Marie, there's about 5% or so, somewhere between 5 and 10% of the NHL is made up of, you know, Russian players. And so, you know, far more obviously than any other, you know, sports league that you would see over here in the States. And so this has obviously, you know, been a very, very important topic to a lot of players. I mean, there's Ukrainian players as well, too. So, you know, just both sides of the spectrum. Alex Ovechkin plays for the Washington Capitals, so he plays in the capital of the United States. He is he's from Russia. He has, campaigned for Vladimir Putin. I mean, he's become friendly with Vladimir Putin over the years. And so he was quiet for several days. He really didn't, he tried to avoid the spotlight, but then at some point it just became too bright and too big, and he had to answer some questions, and he didn't really come out forcefully against anything. He really just kind of came out to try to say, look, you know, war is bad. We need to live in times of peace. You know, I hope this stops. But he didn't come out and condemn anyone or condemn anything or any of the actions. He's trying to stay, on the bench, to use a hockey term there, as much as he possibly can. I just don't know how he's going to be able to do it. And look, he's not the only one, but he is the face of Russian athletes in America. And so he's just kind of, saddled with having to answer some questions.
And Shep, I understand, he plays for a team, so it's very difficult for there to be any individual sanctions. But from endorsements point of view, is there any consequences for that, for him, the fact that he has so openly supported Putin in times? Is there anyone cutting ties with him or any other Russian athletes?
Yeah, so actually it came out earlier today, Marie, that a financial company that Ovechkin is in a commercial for, and it's a pretty popular commercial that if you're watching a hockey game, on NBC or one of the other networks that carries hockey, especially nationally, you've likely seen this commercial. And so, it's a pretty big deal. It's a nationwide commercial. He's been one of the top two or three, if not the best player in the NHL for the better part of the last, decade and a half. I mean, this isn't some random guy, who just happens to be from Russia and, did some things on social media for Vladimir Putin. He's one of the best, if not the best player in the game. And so they've pulled their commercial. And there's some other You know, equipment groups that are pulling commercials, not just with Ovechkin, with other Russian players as well. You know, look, we've talked a lot about, you know, social justice and movements in the United States and the voice of athletes and, you know, not, you know, companies, you know, I don't want to say getting canceled, but, you know, having problems for if they are on the wrong, quote unquote, wrong side of an issue. I mean, I'm not trying to say that, you know, war is an issue you can be on the right side of. That's not what I'm trying to say. But companies over here are very well aware of, you know, the need to be active when it comes to social things. And this is something that they can't be associated with a guy who, Marie, his Instagram picture is with Vladimir Putin still.
Still. Oh, wow.
It was as of this morning. I don't know if it's been changed since then, but I mean, that's the type of thing that we're talking about, okay?
I understand what you mean as well about the huge companies and their desire to always come out the right side of a message and to hit the right tone. And I suppose one that does come to mind was the Kendall Jenner and the Pepsi one, and how they obviously put a huge amount of money into it, and it was it didn't go down well at all, and there was accusations of cultural appropriation and things like that, and you know, a lot of apologies were needed afterwards, and the advert was pulled. So it just shows that these big companies, they have to be so careful, and they don't want to be associated with anything that puts them in a negative light. Ian O'Riordan from the Irish Times is with us as well. Shep, he's here in studio. And just from that point of view as well, Ian, we are seeing a lot of companies distance themselves from anything Russia related, and you'd imagine that as time goes on, we're going to see a little bit more of that as well, and especially when these bigger tournaments and big games start coming, the fixtures start coming upon us.
Yeah, as it should be. I'm just going to, a quick question for Shep there, if you can hear me, and pardon my ignorance on this, but this player mentioned, I mean, is the season happening now, and if he goes on the field of play, the ice hockey field of play, do you know what kind of reaction he's got or potentially will get?
The NHL season is currently ongoing right now. He hasn't been as available, you know, to media as possible. I mean, look, you're seeing, you know, you're seeing like in the city of Dallas, they've been, you know, lighting up the buildings with like blue and yellow lights. They've had the New Orleans Pelicans wore yellow socks last night. That's not one of their colors, but that they're wearing yellow. I mean, you're starting to see the signs, you know, people are starting to voice their solidarity about what's going on. Again, I'm not a big fan of just banning. This is me personally. I mean, banning any Russian players because they're Russian. You know, I mean, they're not fighting. They're not doing. It would be helpful if they could, you know, come out and take a stand. But, you know, and I put this in my note to Marie and the gang. You know, these guys have families back in Russia. And so they have to be cautious about what they're saying. It's just, unfortunately, that's just where we are in the world. And that's something that I think it's hard to criticize somebody for not coming out and just lambasting this dictator who has just invaded a country. You know, we don't know what he's capable of. And I know that that's what's going on in the heads of these athletes. And I just think that that's something that needs to be taken into consideration, you know?
Okay, and that goes back to your question then, Marie. I wonder, like, is there not pressure, but I mean, if there are endorsements or management teams going after these individuals saying, look, we're going to suspend you, or if there's an endorsement deal there, that might turn them perhaps a little bit more to the kind of stuff that Shep is saying there, you know, to at least be critical in some way of it. But look, it's absolutely precarious situation, I can only imagine. But I think we're already seeing that. And I mean, the fallout for this, I mean, it's not only, again, I mean, I always feel flippant talking about the casualties of sport here, but the amount of Russian athletes who will be so far behind when they do get back into competition. A lot of these, looking at possibly their careers are going to end. A lot of them will retire. A lot of them will walk away from the sport. There's a potential whole generation of Russian athletes across all sports being lost here. Well, maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but there's certainly going to be a long time, I think. We all know that, a very long time before we see Russian international teams competing again. So I think the endorsement thing will be minor to the long-term damage that it's going to do to their careers.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm sorry, Marie. I was just going to say real quick, you know, I mean, we're starting, you know, in Formula One racing, you're seeing, you know, drivers get dropped. You know, they're not going to play, you know, football matches there. I mean, it's just kind of starting. I mean, now I think people are starting to realize that this isn't probably going to end anytime soon, and it's going to be bad no matter how it goes. And, I mean, to Ian's point, I mean, there's going to it's not the athletes. The leagues are just not going to allow, you know, the English teams aren't going to be allowed to just go play in Russia anytime soon. It's just not going to happen. Who would allow their teams to fly over there and go do, you know, go compete in that country? I just don't see that happening.
And what teams as well are going to want to play against Russian teams? And Shep, just in terms of the news cycle, obviously over here it's wall to wall and, you know, it's completely dominating the coverage. Is that the same for you guys?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, the main topic on every newscast at night, but throughout the day during, you know, the cable news as well. And look, you know, the good and the bad of social media is you can kind of be taken around the world in an instant. I think this is, you know, allowing us to see things and you know, learn about people in Ukraine that are surviving and fighting back. But yeah, it's all over. It was the first, I want to say, 15 to 20 minutes of President Biden's he gave his first State of the Union speech on Tuesday night. And it was, you know, a heavy, heavy part of that. And it was the very beginning of it. So, yeah, it is definitely the main topic in the States as well. And look, for a variety of reasons. I mean, it's driving up energy prices. I mean, it's not impacting us from a stance of we're sending troops around the world to go fight. Not yet. And hopefully that it doesn't get to that part. But it is having an impact on the American economy, too.
Just one more point as well. I think it's kind of when you look at FIFA and UEFA to some extent, the International Olympic Committee to an extent. I mean, two of the biggest global sporting federations in the world. I think they both deserve gold medals, probably gold, silver and bronze for the irony, for the cynicism that we've seen over the last 7 days. Like initially, oh well, sport and politics, we cannot get involved with any politics, whether it was IOC in Beijing or FIFA in Qatar or even Russia before that, and now suddenly it's okay to get. Now, I know it's difficult to compare all out invasion with maybe what might be human rights issues, but to say that sport and politics doesn't mix, now we all know it does, but now more than ever, I don't think the IOC can ever say that sport and politics doesn't mix again.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, Shep, thank you so much for joining us and bringing us that update. Ian, stay with me. We have lots more to get through. We're going to take a very quick break and then we're going to look back at the indoors at the weekend and also a few other notable performances last night to get to.
RTE
2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On with me, Marie Crowe. It is 23 minutes past six, and I am delighted to say that Ian O'Riordan is with me in studio, and we're going to get stuck into some athletics. And Ian, we're going to start with the very notable women's performances last night, three of them in particular. So Phil Healy with a PB, and then Sophie Becker and Sarah Lavin also doing really well in Madrid.
Yeah, this is the World Indoor Tour final. So there's been kind of seven or eight high quality meetings over the last number of weeks, and Madrid being the final. And then it's done on point, and this is kind of the last event then before the World Indoor Championships, which are on, I'm going to say, the weekend after next, St. Patrick's weekend in Belgrade. So, and on the back of them, on the back of the National Championships at the weekend, and Phil Healy, you forget sometimes, I mean, to win the national title, it's a big deal in Ireland, whether it's indoors or outdoors, and I think that was her 15th title overall, and not quite a record. There's been a few more since then, but so she came out 3 days later and she ran a 51.66 for 400 metres in Madrid. She finished third. Again, I mean, the Irish record, what is it, 51.58, that belonging to Karen Schenking since 2002. You probably weren't even born for that, were you? It's a long time ago.
I do know who she is, though, because she's very good friends with Dervla O'Rourke, from what I recall. Yeah,
exactly.
That's my association with Karen.
Yeah, no, Karen was an absolutely fantastic runner in her time. Certainly a European Championship finalist over the years. But Phil's been knocking on the door of that record. So what she needs to get down, less than 0.1 of a second. So I think that's one of her goals going into Belgrade. Sarah Lavin as well. She finished her in the 60 metre hurdles, and Sophie Becker, who also have a world indoor qualifying time. And you put that on the back of the National Championship at the weekend, where we saw Molly Scott break the Irish 60 metre record, the first Irish woman to break the 7.20, she ran 7.19. And again, like, that's a world-class time. That's a world-class time. I'm not sure people were aware of that situation, whereby what happened was the final, I think, was penciled in for about 2 o'clock. Gun went off. All eight women sprinted down the lane and sprinted on the track. She won handy. She won by about, certainly by a metre and a half. But then it turns out there was a false start. So there's a false start. The clock stops and it should be a recall gun. But the recall gun didn't go off, or there was some sort of technical fault. So they decided, well, we're going to race again. Literally 45 minutes later, they lined up in the same positions, and this time the clock stopped and started on the 7.19 seconds for Molly Scott. And that's actually the third time she's broken the record this year. She's taken it back off Rashid Adeleke, who'd broken it in the US, and definitely did the standout performance. And as I was just saying to you there off air, sometimes you go to these track and field meetings and you're looking for the standout performance, whether it's men's or women's, but the women definitely set the trend on Sunday when you throw in Sarah Healy's 8.53 for 3K, which was an Irish under 23 record by, I don't know, maybe 15, 16 seconds. So right across the board, I think the women were leading the way.
Just on Molly Scott, so like when you think that it's, you know, she's sprinting and it's, you would look at it and think, right, it's not going to take that much out of someone 60 metres, but like obviously a lot more goes into it than, you know, the untrained eye. How difficult is it to put races back to back like that? And, you know, even the fact that she had expended herself mentally and physically to win a final and then had to do it again and goes on and breaks a record.
Yeah, no, good point. And actually, they'd actually run a semi-final earlier in the day as well, around noontime. So that was actually her third. Now, you say 60 metres, what is it? It's like running up the stairs, I suppose. But no, you're absolutely right. And when they came off the track, because I wasn't sure what happened, and we actually made eye contact, and I was like, what's wrong? And she's like, no, we're running again. And she was, you could see there was a lot of, yeah, rage, basically anger. And she spoke about that afterwards, that she went off, she lay down, she didn't do anything else. She didn't do another warm-up. She just laid out, she just kind of literally sat on the track for half an hour. And then when the gun went, she just like literally put the head down and, as I say, nailed it. But, I mean, I was there for a couple of hours on Sunday, and I was exhausted when I came out of the place, because indoors can be a lot of just waiting around the air, you know, you're in air conditioning, and the, you know, it's a kind of a tiring, strangely tiring place running indoors. But I mean, that to me was the performance of the weekend. I mean, she's still only what, 22, I think, 23 max. So, no, 20 to 23 later this month. So, but her progress, she's coached by her mother, Deirdre, by the way, who didn't have a big background in athletics. So it's kind of this classic family type coaching relationship, which can work both ways. Like, yeah. I know from my own experience.
It's common enough in athletics, isn't it? Like, you do see quite a bit of it here in Ireland anyway, where parents, maybe because, like, as you probably know, and I know my own family as well, that like, it's, you know, you see your parent being an athlete and you follow in their footsteps, and it's what you're used to, and it's the environment in the background you grow up in. And because there isn't coaches everywhere and there isn't athletics clubs everywhere, that often the parent falls in as the coach.
Yeah, no, as I said, when I started running, my dad was my coach, and I have to thank him for a lot. And then I suppose you get to a point maybe when you get a little bit older and you kind of wonder, not wonder, but it's difficult to separate maybe the father from the coach. But I mean, look at the Inge Britsons, probably the most successful distance runners of our generation, and the famous father, although he has stepped away, unfortunately, for health reasons.
And the youngest little boy doesn't do athletics, he does soccer, so I'm dying to see how he is going to get on as well.
Yeah, no, it is. It's
so he's stepped away for health reasons?
So I believe, yes. Oh, wow. So I believe now, again, I'm not sure the exact situation there, but he decided to take a step down for the moment, and maybe it's work related, I'm not sure. But I think the older brother now is taking on, but I don't think Jacob needs a whole lot more coaching when he's
I think it's maybe holding back a little bit.
yes, so, but that was the beauty about Molly's performance, say, on Sunday. Like, it's a very much a homegrown thing, and she comes up to train. I think, you know, she's studying in Dublin at the moment, but she trains on that track, and it's very much a homegrown thing. And I mean, her level of improvement now over the last number of years is definitely, it's at that European kind of standard now, whereby the problem is she's going into a world indoors, where you're going to have the Americans, you're going to have the Jamaicans, and it's going to be a whole new level of competition. But she's at that level now where she can think about getting into a semi-final perhaps, and then maybe a final in two or 4 years' time.
So tell us about Israel Olatunde. So he ran the 60 metres also, 6.62, a championship record, personal best for the 19-year-old, and just 0.01 seconds outside the Irish record, and secured the world indoor standard. Not a bad weekend for Israel.
Yeah, what's that, 3-1 go? No, it is. It's again, another great story with Israel. I mean, born in Ireland, obviously to Nigerian parents, but again, a product of the Irish system. It's not like he arrived in here when he was 16, 17 and already had done a few years in Nigeria. He came through the Dundalk system, and now he's working at a UCD, although still coached with Daniel Gilgallon up in Tala. But he's been knocking on again another old record. Paul Heshen, another one of our old school sprinters, dare I say. His record, I think, is 15 years old. So it's, what is it, 6.61, and Israel's down to 6.62. So that record's going to go. That record's definitely going to go. It may well go.
Yeah, 19. He's like, if he's a lot of years in him now to knock that off.
Yeah, and just when you see him move, like, he's got all the qualities. Like, he's strong, he's really powerful, he's smooth. Because Paul Heschen notoriously didn't have the best running style in the world. He'd be the first person to admit that. But he got the most out of himself, whereas Israel has got the potential. I mean, no Irishman ever born in this country that has ever come near the 10-second barrier. But I think we could be seeing for the first time an Irish athlete capable of going sub 10 seconds.
And that training group up in Tala, it seems to be really getting the best out of the athletes as well.
Yeah, there's a whole load of them up there now, and they're all pushing each other on. And of course, Rashidat Adeleke would have been there too if she wasn't burning up the track over in the US. It's a pity for her because the US NCAA championships are on the same weekend as the World Indoor, so she won't even get the opportunity to compete. But she's happy enough where she is, and she's made a few fast times this year. But they're real hopeful as well. If you talk about Phil Healy, Sophie Becker, then you put Rashidat in there. I mean, the women's 4x400 meter relay team, if they really get their act together, I don't mean their act together, but they really focus on that event. There's no reason why they could not be European Championship finalists later this year, and they should not be too far off a medal position.
Yeah, gosh, so much to look forward to from an athletics point of view. We're in March now and it feels like it's really getting going. And those World Championships are going to come around so quickly. It'd be great to get some finalists in something anyway, you know, and really capture our attention and put the focus on athletics.
Yeah, and a quick shout out for the men as well, though. They didn't all disappoint us. Luke McCann, only 23 as well. He's across the road in the UCD. He literally ran the gun-to-tape solo victory in the 1,500 metres. And the attitude about these guys as well, they're young, they're fearless, they like to think now they can take on the world, but you need to be that way. You know, no one's going to tell you you're good enough if you don't believe it yourself. And I think he really believes now that, and dare I say, inspired by the likes of Ingebrigtsen, who's come out and he said that himself. He's looked at him and said, why is he any different to me? There's no reason that I can't do what he can do. Now, he still has to go a few seconds quicker, obviously, but the attitude amongst these young runners is certainly very encouraging.
Okay, well, on that note, we're going to take a very quick break. We were chatting a little bit earlier about Drive to Survive. I was talking to Laura Fox about it before this show started. It has really hit the mainstream, captured the attention of a lot of people, and so much interest in it. We will be getting into that very shortly.
RTE
2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on 2FM.
Now, Formula One, as anyone that has been following the news today will know, that it cancelled its contract with the Russian Grand Prix. The decision comes 6 days after this year's race was due to take place in Sochi on September 25th, was pulled from the calendar. Now, it is Drive to Survive time. This is a documentary series produced in collaboration between Netflix and Formula One to give a behind-the-scenes look at the drivers and races of the Formula One World Championship. A fourth season covering the 2021 World Championship is scheduled to premiere on the 11th of March on Netflix, and the coverage has increased the interest in the sport from non-Formula One fans. Paul Martin and James Gay-Reese, producers of Formula One Drive to Survive, have been speaking to John Kenny.
The show's almost become part of kind of Formula One, you know, furniture now. You know, there's an expectation that, you know, each year now there's going to be a Drive to Survive, and they're going to let our cameras in. And I think, you know, it's testament to the teams and, you know, the drivers that they let us in.
How did you persuade Ferrari and McLaren then to finally get involved?
I think they just, you know, they saw that the first season worked, and I think they just thought they'd been, you know, however those organizations work, they thought they'd be foolish to not be in it. I mean, Netflix, when it works, is an extremely effective, you know, platform. And so there's you're getting a lot of eyeballs onto your team in a way that, you know, is helpful, I guess. So I think they probably saw that the show is fundamentally a positive thing, and it wasn't a kind of, like, you know, it wasn't mocking the sport or anything, it was trying to be additive, then it wasn't particularly hard to get them in.
You've been handed, like, on a plate, probably the best Formula One story in a very, very long time. So that must have pleased you when you saw the finish of the season.
Yeah, listen, I mean, it was crazy, wasn't it? And I think that, you know, the season was pretty exciting all the way through, actually, but it just ended in an insane fashion, obviously. But, you know, it's at the same time, it's a big responsibility in order to get those couple of episodes at the end of the series right, because normally, you know, normally the championship's done and dusted by, you know, a couple of races before the end. And so we've got a bit of time to try and work out what, you know, how to wrap it up. But this time, you know, obviously this year we had to be there right to the last minute and then turn it around pretty quickly in order to hit the release date. So it was pretty challenging, and there's some very, very, very late nights. But we're enormously pleased with the way those episodes 9 and 10 have come out.
Yeah, I'd say you've had to probably change your plans because of those last couple of laps.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, various holidays were cancelled and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
RTE 2FM.
Game on.
On 2FM with Green Farm. Being flat to the mat isn't real. Our protein is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on 2FM.
Now we will be hearing the rest of that Drive to Survive interview before the show finishes. We are going to turn our attention now to Gaelic football, and I'm delighted to say that Neil Ewing is with me on the line and Ian Reardon is in studio. Neil, I think we're all a little bit guilty of focusing on the top divisions when it comes to Gaelic football, but now more than ever, the lower ones are important. And there's a lot of kind of subplots happening and a lot of teams making waves and probably not getting the attention. And I think when you look at Division 2, Derry is probably one that really has taken people by surprise. 4 games played, 4 wins, 8 points on the board, but it's their performances really that are have people talking.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose the drop of Derry over 4 seasons or 3 seasons really shocked everyone. You know, they went from competing in Division 1 finals all the way down to Division 4, but I think they're on course to go right back up through the divisions at the same speed, and that's testament, I think, to the strength of probably club football in Derry. And you know, it's probably the type of county, you know, club football is so strong. Some of those rivalries are so strong that when it comes to getting together at senior county level, that it sometimes just doesn't work. But I think where Derry have been, I suppose, really clever is getting Rory Gallagher involved. You know, huge pedigree, obviously, from his time with his time as a player, his time with Donegal. He brought Fermanagh forward as well. I just remember thinking at the time it really was a coup for Derry to get Rory Gallagher on board. You know, anybody who has played under him or been involved in any sessions that he's done speaks very, very highly of him. And you know, what he's done, he's come in there an outside voice, and he seems to have got the best players on the pitch. They've obviously had a little bit of success there with a minor All-Ireland in the last 2 years. So yeah, I think huge credit due to Rory Gallagher for I suppose number one, getting the best players on the pitch for Derry, and number two, using that coaching now to set them up in a way that has seen them really you know, rattle through the divisions from Division 4. I think it's hard to see them not get promoted from Division 2 this year, and I think they're going to be a dangerous prospect for anybody in Ulster Championship or the back door as the season goes on as well.
Yeah, and that's going to come around really, really quickly as well. The bottom of Division 2 is quite interesting as well, with Cork and Down there just on 1 point each, no wins. And for, I think, a county like Cork in particular, they've been trying to get up, and now they're up and they're in Division 2, and it just hasn't been going to plan for them.
No, I've been a little bit surprised with the form of Cork this year. And, you know, I think they've done a lot off the pitch that's going to set them up for success probably, you know, over the coming decade very well, in terms of support staff that they have employed there on a full-time basis. I know Kevin O'Donovan is involved in an admin role, and also they have some guys on the strength and conditioning side who would have experienced in Munster rugby. So, you know, a lot of that will pay off as the years go by. But yeah, this year, obviously on the back of success that Keith Ricken had with that under-20 group, I thought there may be a little bit more in Cork. You know, they have some very impressive guys. Sean Meehan at the back, anytime I've seen Cork play, he's been hugely impressive. Matty Taylor coming forward from wing back, again, another impressive player. But I think probably the game against Galway maybe summed up where Cork are at. You know, they definitely have the talent. You know, with probably 15-20 minutes to go, there was only a point in that game. but they have lost a huge amount of experienced heads as well. You know, even Mark Collins, Rory Dean, you know, guys that would have a lot of years done with Cork who were not involved this year. And just a young team, they were able to mix it with Galway, who were obviously, you know, a top 8, top 10 team in the country for, you know, I suppose 55 minutes, but just couldn't stick with them down the straight. So, yeah, obviously, I suppose one thing nobody is quite sure of with Cork is, did those older heads step away on their own choice, or did Keith Ricken decide to I suppose, to start with a clean slate and put all his faith in the young players? But they just strike me as a team who could probably do with a little bit of experience now. But the way the fixtures are playing out in Division 2 over the coming weeks, it really is going to be fascinating. It's like a mini league down there at the bottom, I think. Nearly all of the four bottom teams have to play each other, and you know, obviously you have three teams there on 1 point, so I think you're probably going to end up in a situation where this mini-league is going to throw up a team that gets relegated based on head-to-head, the result of a game between themselves. So, yeah, I suppose every game is going to be crucial down there for Cork. Cork, Offaly, Meath and Downs. You know, even to mention those teams as teams that could potentially be dropping into the Tailteann Cup is scary, really.
Yeah, it really is. And look, I think when it comes to management, it's tricky, it's difficult. It takes a while to settle in. And, you know, when Keith Ricken did take over, there was so much fanfare. But the reality is that it doesn't happen overnight and it doesn't always go to plan. And I'd say Wicklow boss Colin Kelly probably found out pretty quickly that, you know, it's a pressurised situation. There's a huge amount of work involved. So he's stepped away now after just over 4 months in charge, work commitments. But also you can see from the table that they're rock bottom of Division 3. They haven't won any games. They just have 1 point out of playing four games, and it's, you know, it's difficult for him obviously to have to step away from a job that he clearly wanted, but he'll definitely have a lot more time in his hands after stepping away from that. And it's just a huge commitment, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge commitment for anybody to get involved in an inter-county team, be it on the playing side or the management side. But, you know, Colin Kelly is very experienced. He's had a stint with Louth. He also had a stint with Westmeath as well. So, you know, he would have known what he was getting involved in when he moved to Wicklow. You know, it's an interesting story for me. I think, you know, sometimes obviously we don't know the personal circumstances or what's happened here, but work commitments is a term that's thrown around when team management teams and we move on at the end of a season, etc. But very strange to see it happen in the GAA at this point in the season. Wicklow had a disappointing start. I think, you know, on such a high, you know, Davy Burke, obviously a very impressive young manager from Kildare, came in, did some great work to get them promoted. Obviously, they probably benefited from the format of last year's league in that they played Cavan in that one-off game where they got a huge win, secured Division 3 football for them again this year. But, yeah, I don't know. It just seems like there should be maybe more happening in Wicklow there. You know, it's a county, obviously, a decent-sized population relative to maybe some of the counties on the West Coast. A lot of their players, even if they're based or living or working in Dublin, should be able to get home and train midweek. They're just a county that maybe seem to be underperforming, and you just hope that, you know, some of the administration or some of the development work off the pitch is matching some of the effort that the players are undoubtedly putting in to prepare themselves to be in the best position possible. And it's going to be pretty unique now to see a county in the GAA looking for a new manager midway through a league season.
Wicklow, yeah, if I could come in to Wicklow there, I mean, there's no doubt they're a bit of an enigma in some ways. And living 100 metres from the Wicklow border, I'm kind of see the best of both worlds in the sense that, as you say, there is a huge catchment area, sort of south Dublin, that spills over into, say, even the Bray area, the Shankill direction, like a huge population mass there. But I've done some articles on Wicklow over the years, and it's like, what is holding them back? They're a bit like this kind of yo-yo team. They make sort of two steps forward, two steps back, one step forward, three steps back. The first problem that they reckon have is the county's divided by mountains. In other words, if you're living in Bray and you need to get to Blessington, or you're living, say, in West Wicklow, you need to get to East Wicklow, you got to cross the mountains or go the long way around. I don't think that's an excuse on its own, but there is, and there's the classic sort of, sometimes it's the club conflict conflict as well. There's a bit of a history of club conflicts there, and players not always wanted to play for the county because of where they come in the club location. But there's certainly a county, a bit like Carlow a couple of years ago. Carlow made great progress. We saw that, and for some reason they just weren't able to sustain it. I really thought when Wicklow got up to Division 3 last year, it wasn't expected. I think it only happened at the last match that they got up there. But I thought that's maybe where they deserve to be, given all the resources that put in. I know they've got some great training facilities down there as well. But for someone like a manager to be leaving at this stage of the year, I definitely think there may be more to it than just a commitment thing. Unfortunately, to say that, I think, and no disrespect to Colin Kelly, I mean he's come out and said it's purely work basis. But I think maybe part of that is the mountainous air that he's dealing with. But I think there's maybe more going on here in Wicklow that meets the eye, and that's why it's a bit of an issue, I suspect.
Yeah, probably is. Look, I think maybe when you do look at the table and you see a big zero under the W, it is a little bit of an issue, all right? But they don't have that issue down in Limerick. So they have 3 wins. They're top of the table, 6 points. And Billy Lee just really seems to be getting the best out of these players, Neil.
Yeah, Billy Lee has done, I think, an amazing job there. You know, he's probably one of the longer serving managers in the country. You know, you can see from even some games, even challenge games where we would have played Limerick over the year, you can just see the passion that he has for Limerick football, even from seeing him on the line. But, you know, his history of involvement with club and county teams in Limerick, I think maybe was it 2017 where they had some issues even around the naming of their team before a championship game and the availability for a meal for the players after the game. So, you know, Billy has stuck with them through thick and thin, and, you know, he's probably dug in and fought the ground of the players on some of that stuff. And, you know, it's really starting to pay off. And I think not just Billy, there's obviously a huge amount of work going on there behind the scenes in Limerick. I think maybe Paul Kinnerick, who's obviously probably more well known for his hurling exploits, is involved in some of the development work there. But, you know, they've kept some past players like Pa Ranahan involved there in development teams. And I think that's starting to pay off. But again, payoff is maybe the incorrect term. As you know, Limerick, again, a county with a huge population, obviously hurling and rugby would be big draws in Limerick as well, but they definitely should have the footballers to be competing at Division 2 level, I would say, for sure. And you know, one thing with Limerick football teams over the years is, you know, they've always had athletes because of or decent athletes because of that large pick they have. So it's great to see some of the groundwork put in by Billy, and I suppose the wider Limerick football family really pay off. And nice to see them on top of Division 3. And, you know, I think it'll be for the GAA, it'll be good to see Limerick footballers pushing on to Division 2 and also the Munster Championship. You know, it's not really that long ago, you know, probably back to around the 2010 or maybe just before that, where Limerick were competing with Cork and Kerry for Munster Championships. And, you know, they were a real a top quality team, and, you know, they should be able to maybe if not every year be competitive in Munster, but I definitely think they're a team that should be competing for a Munster Championship maybe, you know, 3-4 in every 10 years as well, and picking off the odd ones. So all credit to them for the work that's gone in, and hopefully they can keep driving that forward.
Yeah, for sure. Neil, thank you so much for joining us. And there are a few of those Division 3 and 4 games on this weekend. Now, there is some breaking rugby news. So the Six Nations women's team, Ireland, has been named just now ahead of the Six Nations. And there are a couple of notable absentees. So Cliona Maloney and Sene Naiopou are both left out of Ireland's squad. So they are two quite high profile players. And for Maloney, who played in all eight of Ireland's games in 2021, she played in all 8 of Ireland's games. Yes, I'm trying to get the words out. So she hasn't been included in the squad. And what's interesting about Cliona Maloney not being included is that she is the player who described comments made by Anthony Eddy, who has just stepped away from his role as the director of women's rugby, as slurry spreading. So Ian, when you're talking about there being more to things, you'd have to think there probably is a little bit more to this, and the review will be published tomorrow. I'd imagine we might get a little bit more information about Cliona and what's happening in that. So do please tune in tomorrow, because we will be dissecting what comes out of it. Now, though, we are going to jump back into John Kenny's interview with Drive to Survive producers Paul Martin and James Gay-Reese.
What kind of access do you think you've got? Do you think you've got full access?
I think we've got good. I think we've got really good access. I mean, you know, I think when you're covering that many teams and that many drivers, you know, you couldn't have full access to, you know, you round the clock. You know, I think we get, you know, we get really good access, you know, particularly given the background of the sport and where the sport had been previously. You know, it's tough because they have an incredibly stressful day job, you know, which is to go out and get these cars on track and win points and win races and win championships. So, you know, you're always going to be having to fight against the demands of that. But, you know, yeah, I think if you'd have offered the access of where we are now when we first started this show, you know, we'd have bitten your hand off.
Yeah. So do you think they're more open then? Because we've seen so many pictures down the years of, say, a car comes in and they'll put a hood over the back wing so nobody else can see it, whatever. Are you getting access beyond that from what Joe Public is seeing?
I mean, we don't really focus on the kind of the tech side of things. So really what we just want is access to the individuals, you know. And so that's definitely getting easier as every year goes by, because people kind of enjoy it and they see the benefit of it. So, you know, we don't take it for granted. It's always a bit of an arm wrestle, because as Paul said, you know, they're more concentrated on either staying or surviving or winning a world championship. But you know, there's a pretty good understanding between us and the teams. I mean, we're on very good terms with the teams. And if it continues, then I think, you know, they'll probably be able to be in it more.
Yeah, I think that was part of the... I remember when we first started the show and, you know, when we went, you know, we went into the garages for the first time and they were adamant that we couldn't point a camera at certain parts of the engine and they were amazed that we didn't care. Like, it's not what we're here for.
Well, you're actually speaking like true journalists there, because you're more interested in the input of the teams, where the money comes from, how it's divided, how the drivers get there in the first place. And that is the drive to survive, isn't it? Okay, the technical stuff is, you know, the ordinary fan, well, a lot of them do, but most of them don't. They see the drivers, they see the cars, and that's about it. And obviously your full concentration is how that package is put together, I would assume.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, listen, you know, it's good TV is when, you know, basically the people that you're watching are relatable. Do you know what I mean? You know, you've got to be able to relate to those young drivers or the team principals, whatever takes your fancy. But because, you know, for years, the sport basically was, you know, the drivers were guys in helmets going round and round in circles. You know, there wasn't a lot of insight into who they were as individuals. So I think anything was going to be a significant sea change on that. And, you know, surprise, surprise, some of them are quite interesting. And, you know, you want to spend some time with them, you know, and they do something which is actually very dangerous. So when you put it all together, it's a good proposition.
Yeah, because Formula One drivers now are actually seen as being, I suppose, very much a product of their environment. Back in the days, 70s, 80s, drivers' wives were all friendly together. They went drinking together, partying together. Now it's much more sanitized, for want of a better phrase. So it's obviously, from your point of view, is to get behind the driver and get into their mind and show people, like, look at, you know, despite what you're seeing on screen, this guy is actually quite an interesting driver.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, I think the teams have realized that the more they put in, the more they're going to get out of it. You know, we can't do much with a little bit of access, but, you know, we didn't need a huge amount in order to kind of make, you know, develop some truths about some of these characters. So, you know, it's as part of our job was to kind of work out where we think the stories are going to be, which drivers are going to have interesting years, and then, you know, treat them with respect and kind of, you know, elevate their situations. And I think actually, you know, it's there to be done in a way, because there's only 20 of these kids in the world that do this. And, you know, it's not an easy thing to do, you know. And also, I have a huge amount of respect for people who work in Formula One, because it's a grueling schedule. And some of those people, even like the team photographers, I was speaking to the guy who does Red Bull's photographs. I mean, he's been doing it for like 20 years, every weekend of his life. You know, it's a major commitment. But it's a very addictive sport. And even we're quite addicted to it now. Once you get into it, you know, you can't really imagine life without it.
Yeah, it is, because you all travel in a circus together and one journalist might get a story, go, where did you get that one from, whatever. But I suppose, just kind of wrap things up, any sympathy for one Mr. Lewis Hamilton after what happened at the end of the season?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, I think it was an extraordinary effort by Max and Lewis, you know, across the whole of the season. And I think, you know, for either of them to lose in that last race was pretty harsh. And for Lewis to lose in the way that he did, whatever you think of it, you know, rightly or wrongly, you know, must have been an absolute kind of gut punch. So, yeah, I just complete sympathy. But, you know, I think, you know, Max didn't do anything wrong. Max just, you know, took advantage of what was presented to him and he won. And, you know, it was difficult not to feel pleased for Max and Red Bull, but at the same time feel, you know, crushed for kind of Lewis and Toto as well.
Now, so that was the producers of the new season of Drive to Survive, which is on Netflix. And the producers are Paul Martin and James Gay Reese, and they were talking to John Kenny. Now we have to go. Ian O'Riordan, thank you so much for joining us. Up next is the RTÉ Choice Music Prize live from Vicar Street.